Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Dool.
And this is a podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what are you on time to this week?
I have been reading A Less by Andrew Sean Greer, which was published, I want to say about 2017. It won the Pulitzer, I think, in 2018. And it is a book that has been on my shelf for ages, probably since about 2017, if I'm honest with you. And I did that thing that I so rarely do and should do more of, which was just pick it entirely at random off my shelf. I was looking for something to read that was not work reading or something, it was entirely at random. Yes, like that'll do. Let's go with that. And I'm really glad I did because I so enjoyed it. It's a novel about Arthur Less, who is a sort of not unsuccessful, but not wildly successful novelist. He's had a couple of novels out. He's had, a modicum of success, but he's certainly not troubling the bestseller lists, shall we say. And he has been, well, for a long time, he was in a relationship with a slightly older man who was part of this kind of very well-respected sort of poetry, art, literature type circle. They've broken up, although they are remained kind of close friends. And Arthur subsequently had a 9-year relationship with a guy called Freddie, who he's sort of been, it was never an exclusive relationship. It was very off and on again. And by that point, Arthur is the older man in the relationship. Freddie's, a fair bit younger than him. And at some point, basically, Freddie's come along and said, look, there has been someone else, and I'm going to get married to him. So we will be together exclusively. And this is the end of us. And Arthur is sort of, I think, kind of almost surprised. He almost surprises himself by being completely heartbroken by this, and so he's invited to Freddie's wedding to the other guy, and he doesn't want to decline because he doesn't want to like be talked about as, oh my God, he didn't come to the wedding, but also he didn't really want to go to the wedding either. So he decides, as a way to avoid the whole thing, that he's going to accept every invitation that's kind of sent his way. So he ends up agreeing to go to New York to chair an event with this science fiction writer. He agrees to go to somewhere in South America, I think it is, to accept a prize. He goes to Germany for a few weeks to teach a course for, a couple of months. He agrees to go to somewhere else on holiday for, he's like in the desert with a friend, and it's going to be his 50th birthday while he's out there. And anyway, it basically agrees to these sort of slightly mad trips. But it's just what I loved about it is it's got a huge amount of heart. It's very, very funny, and it's sort of exactly my kind of slightly deadpan humor. And there's a quote quite near the beginning that sort of just sums up the humor of it, which says, "The letter is in German. The university is under the impression Arthur Less is fluent in German, and Arthur Less's publisher, who recommended him, is also under this impression. So is Arthur Less. With God's happiness," he writes back, "I accept the pedestal of power," and he sends it off with a flush of pleasure. It's just that sort of, there's a lot of warmth to it. It's the kind of book that feels at the time that you're reading it like it's kind of relatively light, but the more you read it, the more there is sort of underneath. It's brilliant with character. Yeah, it's kind of lovely and charming and funny and bittersweet, and I just it's made me happy to read it.
Oh, well, that's good to hear because it's also been on my shelf since it won the Pulitzer.
You have to get to it.
I will do one day, one day. We can't add it to the spreadsheet now because you've read it,
No,
so
I'm so sorry.
I'll get there eventually.
So what about you? What have you been reading?
So I've got a confession, Kirsty. I have been reading something that I read for a book club that I have joined.
A
And
book club. Didn't
so
seem the sort.
no, I am not a fan of book clubs. I've been a member of two, one less successful than the other. The thing that I don't like about book clubs, right, is other people picking the books. Well, people pick such shit. There we are. However, the book club that I've
I,
go
sorry, I
on.
was going to say, I was in a book club. I've only been in one book club, and I was in it for a good 4 years, and one of the worst books I've ever read in my entire life was a choice for that book club, which
What's
was Me Before You by JoJo Moyes.
the
Genuinely made
film?
me furious.
Well, the difference with this book club is that it's run by Katie Clapham, who is the owner of Storytellers Inc. in Lytham St. Anne's. And she does she so she runs a book club where they have meetings in the shop. But she's been doing her Substack for a year now, I think. And I subscribe to her Substack because it's great. It's very funny. So she does a thing called Receipt from the Bookshop, where she writes about what's happened in the bookshop that day, because she's trying to disabuse everybody of the notion that having a little independent bookshop isn't anywhere romantic. And also, just her recommendations are really good, so I enjoy it. We've got a fairly big crossover in terms of the stuff that we like, I think, including the telly stuff that she writes about. So she chooses all the books basically for the book club. So I'm like, this sounds like a fairly sensible idea. And she decided that what she was going to do was run. So she does three. There's three different times you can go to the. So she doesn't. There's 40 members, I think, in the shop, and there's three different slots they can go to. But then she's also running it online, so it's just in the comments section at the minute on Substack, which means I don't have to see anybody's face. We don't like you can say what you want. You don't have to have like you're not having a like you know one of those where you know somebody's getting annoyed with you in the corner because they completely disagree with what you said. And there's not been too many people for this first one, but it's been quite good fun. And to be fair, it's a hardback. I'll talk about that in a minute. But next one is one of the Celia Dale reissues, which I'm really looking forward to. So the first book that we've read, and it's been everywhere, like it's all over Waterstones' window at in Manchester, not Piccadilly, Deansgate, is Northwoods by Daniel Mason. Now, Daniel Mason wrote a book called The Piano Tuner years ago that I had on my shelf for ages and didn't read, and sent it to the charity shop at some point without having read it. But I think that's what most people know him from. So I'd never read him before. But this is set in a house deep in New England. It starts like way back, basically when the Puritans have arrived and finding out people to burn because they think they're witches and all that. And it goes right through to sort of present day. So, and it's all written in different forms. So, some of it's sort of like straightforward narrative, but you also get section where it's letters written between two characters. There's a true crime thing, there's a journalist, there's an academic. So you get all these sorts of different types of writing telling the story, and each time you're sort of working out what the character's connection is to what's gone before. So I think it was The Observer. So the reason I picked it up was because The Observer had compared it to Cloud Atlas, and Cloud Atlas is one of my favorite novels. It's not like Cloud Atlas. It's more like Sarah Taylor's The Shore. I don't know if people remember that,
Not
but
like that.
it was shortlisted for the Women's Prize and for the Young Writer of the Year award back, can't remember what year it was, 2015 maybe. It reminded me more of that. But yeah, so and you get songs in it, and you get all sorts of different things. Like some of the chapters are really short bits. I think Katie referred to them as palate cleansers when she was writing about it. But I mean, some of the stuff, I mean, I love this sort of stuff because it's experimental. It's got that sort of links between the two. Some of the best bits. So at the beginning, this guy basically comes across, he gets shown by one of the young Indigenous Americans this apple tree, basically. And that's when he buys the land and builds the house. And he thinks the apple's like the greatest thing he's ever tasted. So that's when he starts to sort of cultivate the orchard. And he brings his family across, who aren't, his wife's not delighted about it to start with. But his daughters grow up there. Next chapter is his daughters. The daughters chapter is brilliant. That's one of the ones. So there's a few of the chapters where you could pull it out as a short story, like wholesale, like you could just read it without knowing any of the other context. Their story is absolutely brilliant. So one of the sisters is a bit more introverted than the other, and the other one just wants to, like, she is man obsessed and just wants to go off, and the other sister can't bear for her to leave, so that becomes a sort of bit of bone of contention between him. And I still want to tell you what happens, but I don't want to give the end away.
No,
But
because I've got it on my shelf. I bought it recently because of Waterstones. Like, I absolutely fell for Waterstones, hyping it up. And there's not long ago, they opened a branch of Waterstones, really close to my office, and I have to walk past it every day on my way to the tube, which is dangerous. And I snapped one day and bought a copy. So I've got it on my shelf, and I'm desperate to read it. But no spoilers, please.
Okay. So this is really cool. This isn't a spoiler, but what happens from the very first character, the characters all end up hanging around, so they become ghosts and haunt some of the characters later. So they keep popping back up, which is great. And the sisters pop up fairly often, which is just a delight. And then the chapter, I think it's the chapter after them, is the letters one, and it's these two really good friends who are writing to each other, and that turns into something else. So there was a couple of times where there is a genuine twist in it. It's not a reveal, it's a proper twist. And I didn't see any of them coming, which I love, because, it's that thing when you read a lot that it's quite often you can see that sort of thing coming, and I didn't. I thought the first half was stronger than the second, but now having had sort of a week since I finished it, I'm thinking a lot about the second half and what he does with it, and how he I suppose how he uses a true crime element, how he, and I sort of said when I was talking about it in the book group that you can tell he's an academic because there are several academics towards the end. And I thought he got a little bit bogged down in that, but actually once we started discussing the ending, I was like, oh, and he sets this up and he does it. And so yeah, I'm still thinking about it a week on. And definitely the sisters are living rent-free in my head. So always a sign of a good book when the characters won't leave you alone.
Yeah,
Yeah.
no.
Oh, I've got six. Oh yeah, I did say it's John Murray's, didn't I? I think I did. But it's just come out in our back anyway. It's everywhere. So yes, highly recommend.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting to it eventually. And that book group sounds great as well, because I actually do quite like the concept of the book group of sitting around and talking about a book. But yeah, I think if the choices are not necessarily your taste, I read some great books in my book group, and I read some absolute howlers. And very occasionally, I was surprised. The ones that I expected to be good were not, and the ones I expected to be awful were not. It's just a time thing, actually. And so one where it's kind of online and in a comment section, I could probably get on board with. But I can't sign up to anything else, dear God. But I do want to, I think I probably will sign up to her Substack, because clearly I need more Substacks in my life.
I am now paying for a few, so I've ended up getting rid of a few recently just because finances and all that, and you can just end up signed up to way too many.
Yeah.
This is one of the ones that I've kept because I just think it's great. So there we are.
Recommendation indeed. Right, we've got two books to talk about today. The short version is both are completely brilliant, so this should be a good one. So the two books we're going to talk about are The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay, which was published by Fleet in 20, I won't say 2018, but let me just check. Yes, 2018. And the other book is non-fiction, Close to the Knives, A Memoir of Disintegration by David Runorovich. Yes. So last week I couldn't pronounce it, and this week I looked it up on YouTube, Runorovich. And that, well, it was originally published in 1991, but the edition I've got here was reissued by Canongate as part of their Canongate canons. In 2017. So yeah, but I think we're going to start with The Great Believers, which is sort of my perfect sort of novel, really. It's a big novel that looks at a group of friends, sort of friends and relatives, over two timelines. Part of the action is set in the mid-80s. We're at the height of the AIDS crisis. Although that suggests the AIDS crisis is over, but you know what I mean. And the other section is set nearly present day, 2015, where we're meeting back up with some other characters, and we're seeing essentially who has survived and who has not, and how those relationships have developed over the intervening sort of 30 years. I have wanted to read this for a really long time, actually, and the kind of final recommendation for it actually came from a colleague of mine who I've got quite similar taste in books to, and she said that she'd given it as a present to a good friend of hers who's a gay man, and his sort of initial reaction had been, why would I as a gay man want to read a straight woman on the AIDS crisis? And then he read the book and apparently came back and went, "It's amazing, it's completely wonderful." And that was sort of the recommendation that sealed the deal for me. So when you suggested this one for the podcast, and I absolutely jumped at it, and it was just as good as I hoped, really. In fact, better than I hoped. I will stop talking in a minute, but I think the thing that strikes me first and foremost is her characterization, and she deals with a very large cast of characters, and she deals with them so incredibly well. I think it would be so easy to, if you're writing about a group of gay men in the 80s, it would be so easy to make them identikit and sort of just indistinguishable from each other. And I think what she does is distinguishes them really well, but in a not in a heavy-handed way. I think she's absolutely amazing characterization. But that might not be what you want to talk about straight away, so I'm going to shut up and let you talk a bit. Hello.
Hello. No, I'll talk about the characterization because I don't know if we've talked about this on the podcast before, but I talk about this sometimes when I'm chairing. So I am an absolute nosy fucker, right? So I always read the acknowledgements. I read the entire thing because I want to know whether the person who's given the blurb is their best mate. I want to know which writers they hang around with and who's reading their early drafts and all the rest of it. And there were two things that stood out to me in the acknowledgements for this. So one, sort of relating to your friend's friend, is she talks about where are we? This project was undertaken with a great deal of ongoing thought and conversation and concern about the line between allyship and appropriation, a line that might feel different to different readers. It's my great hope that this book will lead the curious to read direct personal accounts of the AIDS crisis, and that any places where I've gotten the details wrong might inspire people to tell their own stories. And I think the other thing was, she says, "Most important, my endless thanks for the time, patience, and encouragement of those who lived through all this and sat down to coffee or let me into their homes or email me with endlessly in many cases, or sorry, or email with me endlessly in many cases about personal and traumatic things." And then she sort of ends that, "To the memories of the amazing men you all told me about, I did my best." And so I wonder whether that the amount of research she did has helped her to create these characters, because I'm not suggesting, and she says they're not based on real people, but even if they're composites, what she does, and this was the thing that really struck me about it, was although this is a book about the AIDS crisis, that's not the focal point of the story. So the focal point of the story is that Yale, who's the character we follow most closely, he works for one of the universities,
Northwestern in Chicago.
and he is they've through someone he knows, so it's his friend Nico's sister Fiona. So Nico's the first of the men to die. She it's her is it her aunt great
Great
aunt
aunt, yeah.
her great aunt wants to bequeath these drawings to them, because she was knocking around in Paris in 1920 in the 1920s with I'm going to mispronounce his name, Mogliani,
Modigliani.
Modigliani, and a few other big artists, and she falls in love with this artist, what's he called, Ranko Novak, who nobody's heard of because he killed himself fairly early on, and his drawings aren't great. But she wants him included in the show because she had this mad passionate love affair with him. And so the whole bit of Yale's story really is about these paintings and what happens to them and the family dynamics and the Sort of the comparisons between her generation living through the war and them living through this crisis, which feels like a type of war and this lost generation. So I think, yeah, sort of two things. One, that there's the focus isn't it. It's not a book about people dying of AIDS. That's something that happens to them as they live their lives. And the other thing was the connections in it. So what she does really well. So I thought until the end, which was all right, I am going to do spoilers later on. I will warn you when I'm going to do it, but I need to talk about the end because I think it's really clever and really well done. But these two separate time periods. So I heard Patricia Duncan talk years ago now saying that you shouldn't do two separate timelines because what happens is the reader's always like hooked more into one than the other. And what you get sometimes is different readers will prefer different timelines. And I much preferred the 80s stuff to the current day stuff. It comes together sort of beautifully at the end. But one of the things that she does is there are all these echoes that occur. So like there's a bit, so Novak damages his hand, and there's a point where Fiona, the main character in the present day stuff, has damaged her hand. So and then there's the bit, so the woman who they're trying to get the art off, she's in a wheelchair. There's a point where Yale goes to the exhibition in a wheelchair. Like there's all these echoes, there's loads of them that echo throughout the book, but she never does it by apart from the odd bits, like where there's the comparison between the war and what's happening to the men and some women, what but predominantly gay men at that time. That's the only time she sort of points it out really obviously, but there are like if you're paying attention, there's all these sort of beautiful details that link that knit it all together, which I thought as a writer, she's like so skilled, so skilled.
Yeah, and the way that she introduces references to characters in the present day or characters in the 80s that then pop up in the other time frame, she's not heavy-handed with it. Like, so Cecily, who is I think a really interesting character, she appears quite early in both sections, but only sort of in the, particularly in the 2015 section, she's sort of only mentioned in passing initially. And at that point, there's only been a couple of mentions of her in the 80s section, and in both sections, her sort of importance grows. And I think she does that incredibly well because I think it must be really tempting to sort of, if you know where you're going with a character, it feels like she's been very good at holding back and not sort of revealing too much too soon. I think she's great at sort of pacing the reveals, and there are some big reveals, pacing the reveals throughout the book.
Yeah, because so when I went back to so what I do when we're reading, some people are going to hate this. I'm sure I've said it before. I fold corners over. Sorry, people, but I do. So when I go back to do my notes for before we record, I went back and I was like, oh my God, I've turned corners over at bits that are foreshadowing what happens later. And I turned it over because I thought it was interesting, not because. And then I was like, oh my God, she totally told us that was going to happen. It was absolutely there. So yeah, it is really well done, really well done.
Yeah, I loved it. And it doesn't, there were so many points in it where I thought I knew what was going to happen. And it absolutely, you know, there were a good couple of reveals where I didn't see it coming. And I think that's particularly hard to do in sort of the more literary novel. Like you kind of, because with more sort of commercial stuff, I feel like sometimes you're kind of waiting for those reveals, you're expecting reveals. And so for something like this, that's more literary in tone, I think it can be harder to pull off reveals in a way. But she does it incredibly well. And there's a couple of moments that I just found absolutely heart-stopping, really.
Yes, this what I don't want to spoil, like even though I've said I'm going to talk about the ending, I don't want to spoil
No, let's try not to.
one of them, one of the things, one of the reveals. But it was so shocking that I gasped. Like I actually gasped and was just like, what the fuck? And one of the things she does, right, I'm going to be a bit of a wanker now, but one of the reason I think that's so well done is what she does is that thing where you think you know, or the person that's relating that character to you think you know who that character is. And then it's revealed that the person that you've been see the person whose eyes you've been seeing that character through has got that character all wrong. And it reminded me of this, why I'm going to be a wanker, I'm going to read this. So it reminded me of this Philip Roth quote, which if I haven't read on the podcast before, I'm amazed because I quote this like all the time in real life, like a dick. I don't even like Philip Roth's work particularly, but this is genius. So this is from American Pastoral, which I have never managed to finish because I think it is boring as shit. That's going to get me loads of grief, but there we are. But fairly, well, it's about 50 pages in, I think. It's like a fairly well-known quote now, I think. There's this bit when he talks about you fight your superficiality, your shallowness, so as to try to come at people without unreal expectations, without an overload of bias or hope or arrogance, as untank-like as you can be, sans cannon and machine guns and steel plating half a foot thick. You come at them unmenacingly on your own 10 toes instead of tearing up the turf with your caterpillar treads. Take them on with an open mind as equals, man to man, as we used to say, and yet you never fail to get them wrong. You might as well have the brain of a tank. You get them wrong before you meet them, while you're anticipating meeting them. You get them wrong while you're with them, and then you go home to tell somebody else about the meeting, and you get them all wrong again. It's the whole same, sorry, since the same generally goes for them with you, the whole thing is really a dazzling illusion. The fact remains that getting people right is not what living is all about anyway. It's getting them wrong that is living. Getting them wrong and wrong and wrong, and then on careful reconsideration, getting them wrong again. That's how we know we're alive. We're wrong. Maybe the best thing will be to forget being right or wrong about people and just go along for the ride. But if you can do that, well, lucky you.
That
And
is
I just thought, I wondered whether she'd had it pinned on her wall as she was writing, because it felt so like that's what she was doing, was.
Yeah.
Yeah, you thought you knew who these people were. And yeah, as we've said, there are some shockers as to they're not who you think they are.
Yeah, absolutely. And people behaving in ways that you're not expecting and doing things that you're not expecting and, you know, turning up places that you're not expecting them to turn up. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. I just think this is one of my novels of the year, one of my books of the year.
I think it's one that I need to sit on for a bit. That's not saying I didn't love it.
Yeah.
It's not as experimental as the stuff, like, you know what I mean? It's I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the reading experience, and I really enjoyed how skilled she is with it. The one thing, so spoilers, so if you want to fast forward for a couple of minutes, although I don't think it's a spoiler to say, not necessarily a spoiler in this sense, to point out that one of the main characters dies. But what she does at the end that I just thought was absolute genius, which a lesser writer would not have done. So what she could have done, because you know, not too early on, but you know early-ish on that the main character in the 80s thing is going to die. And like you're anticipating it. I mean, as a reader, I sat there because I felt so connected to him. That obviously I was like, he's going to survive in it. He's going to, like, you can't write a novel about the AIDS crisis and have your main character survive, I don't think. But I kept hoping he was going to. And then obviously you get the news that he's not going to. And at that point, so that's the most experimental chapter in the book. So the point, you're not ever directly told, you get him writing a list of all the things that he loves, interspersed with things that the doctor said to him. So that's done brilliantly because it's not the you don't sit through the conversation in the office. It doesn't happen. And then at the end, you're told fairly early, like it's maybe the last 60 pages, I can't quite remember, but you're told in the current timeline, I think it is, that he dies. So you know, and you're told the details of his death through the perspective of so Nico's sister Fiona, who's survived and is the sort of main character in the second half, you're told about his death from her perspective. So you don't what you don't get because it's already been undercut, you know exactly what's coming. And although you do get a death scene at the end, you have not got that really mawkish, sentimental build up, which I think would cheapen the whole thing. So I thought what she did when it got to that point, when Yale finds out that he's infected, it changes slightly, but within the context that she gets away. I'm not quite sure how she gets away with it because she's not done it prior to that in the book, but somehow she pulls it off. And I wonder if it's just the way the two timelines start to converge. But it's so brilliantly done that I just thought, in terms of, is this one of my novels of the year? Potentially for that, because I just thought that was so I keep saying it's really skillful. It is that I think that's the biggest compliment I could give it, is it's so skilled in its execution.
Yeah, and I thinking about that section, that section's very much stuck out to me, and I think it is partly because it is that departure in style from what you said, but also it's just such a loaded moment. I think maybe the reason that it works, despite it, other sitting quite apart in what is otherwise very traditional novel, traditionally told novel. I think it's because we feel we know Yale so well by that point. She's so good at, it comes back to the characterization. She's so good at the characterization that we learn how he feels and how he processes things, even completely unrelated to illness and death, particularly through the art stuff and all around Providence and all that kind of thing. I think she's so good at letting us feel like we know him, that when he has this devastating news, and it's almost a kind of separate, kind of like you say, you're seeing it at a remove because it's sort of his brain sort of wandering off and not quite confronting it full on himself at that point, that it's all the more devastating. I think that's what my instinct is. That's why it works. It's because we feel so attached to Yale. We've seen him go through so much already, and there's already been big shocks. That, I think we're just all rooting for him, and then for him also to be diagnosed. And at that point, obviously, it's nearly always a absolute death sentence. You kind of, I think you feel it all the more.
I think as well, one of the things that I found really interesting, which I know is back to one of these conversations that's been happening forever, that I find a bit boring, but I think it's really well done in this, is that the characters are, I mean, I would say everybody's in it is unlikable or messy or whatever current sort of phrasing you want to use. But there's something really interesting in the way that actually that's what makes them human. And the thing where we find out things that are sort of shocking and unexpected, when you find them out, you're like, well, of course, that's it was there. She was leading you down a different way. So it was there all the time and you've seen it. And I thought there was something, yeah, I suppose I was trying to work out. I'm like, why am I so invested in Yale when actually there's parts of him that aren't very nice? There's parts of him that are really naive. And I'm like, is this not just all of us? That's where I got to, was that they felt like real people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where I was going with what I was saying right at the beginning, is that it doesn't, she doesn't ever, I don't think, fall into the trap of cliched gay man in the 80s. She writes real people.
The other thing I wanted to talk about, and this is going back to Cecily again, but also Fiona, we've not really talked that much about the present day timeline. So what's happening in the present day is that Fiona's daughter is missing. So basically, well, not missing, she's fucked off. She joined a cult with a man, sorry, bit of a spoiler. So, fast forward 10 seconds if you don't want to hear it, with a man who turns out to be Cecily's son. And yeah, so they've joined a cult, and now she knows, Fiona knows she's in Paris, so she's flown to Paris under some sort of, well, not a pretense, but also Richard, who's one of the characters from the first part who survived, who's a photographer, he's got an exhibition coming up, and so she's gone over sort of for two things, but she's looking for Claire. And there's some really interesting things I thought about mothers and daughters, because this is something we've talked about before. And one bit I thought, because Fiona actually, so she's the person who ended up nursing basically everybody. So she's the one who's ended up being everybody's power of attorney. She's been the one who's been in the hospital rooms holding their hands when they've died. And has become sort of sanctimonious, I think. Like, she's not a very nice, there is this sort of sense, and that's partly why her daughter's left, is because she feels like she was second to like all these people, and particularly because Yale died the day before. Is it day before or the day after she's born? Like, around the same time she's born. So that's become like a sort of defining thing for Claire in her life. So, but there's this whole thing where, so obviously there's this awful relationship with them, and I thought there were some really interesting things that Mackay had to say about this. So just a couple of bits that I wanted to quote. There's some really sort of beautiful sentences in this book as well, where she just, some that are beautifully written and some where she just absolutely nails a kind of what people are like. So where are we? It'd help if I, you know what? It'd help if I underlined things in biro. This is like back to our first episode. I don't do that. I just fold the pages over and then I can't find the bloody sentence that I want. So there's a bit when Fiona talks about, and this is interesting. Again, it's one of those echoes. So Yale really early on talks about not wanting his heart broken. And this is Fiona. And she says, oh, she's telling Claire about Richard's exhibition. She was tempted to imply that this was the main reason she'd come over, that Claire was secondary, but why? For pride. It had been her failing with Claire all along, pretending not to love her as much as she did, trying to steel herself against a broken heart the way she would with a boyfriend. The first time she and Damien had gone to couples therapy, the therapist had finally said, "What are you afraid will happen if you open yourself up to him completely?" And Fiona, already crying, had shouted, "He would die." It clearly wasn't what the therapist had expected to hear. He hadn't been a very good therapist. But that whole thing about, like, she can't even tell her daughter that she loves her in the way she should love her because of, like, she's so broken from watching her brother and all his friends die. So I thought that was interesting in the way she's abandoned her daughter, right? And then she says, so when she sees Cecily, so Cecily and Kurt sort of reconcile. We don't really know how big a reconciliation it has been. But she says, they sat a couple of feet apart on the couch. Fiona knew this must be painful for Cecily, but she couldn't imagine being the one, as a mother who'd broken off contact, the one who'd given up. And I just thought, wow, there's some projection going on there, lady. Because they both abandon their kids, but in different, and she doesn't see it as an abandonment of Claire, when I just think, oh my God, how could you not, like, show your kid how much you loved her?
No, absolutely. And I think it, I think that's one of the great things she does with the book, actually, because it would be, again, really easy to fall into the kind of Florence Nightingale nursing cliche that Fiona has spent all of this time and emotional energy caring for these men. But although she did them an extraordinary service, it has damaged something in her as well, and has made her, it has made her a more difficult person. And I think that's sort of brave, actually. It's quite a brave thing to do. A very clever thing to do, I think.
Yeah, I mean, Claire undercuts it all, doesn't she? When you get Claire's, so when Claire's dialogue, and she's just like, oh yeah, I can't remember what how she refers to her, but it is basically the, like, oh yeah, Florence fucking Nightingale, I've heard it all. Whatever. Yeah.
Totally.
And I don't want to spoil it, but there is a whole other thing that she did that was to do with someone else's mother, that is something else that's damaged her in terms of mothers. Like, there's a lot of abandonment, but I guess that's, I suppose, gay community. I mean, even now, but particularly at that time, parents abandoning their kids because they can't deal with the fact that they're gay, because they live in a society where they're told it's wrong. Like, there's a lot. I mean, we haven't really talked about the political stuff, but obviously there's a lot of political stuff in this, but it's like an undercurrent through, it's not a, oh, I wouldn't describe it as a political, I mean, it's political in the sense that it's about AIDS in America at that time, and also the fact it's set in Chicago and not in New York, which I thought was great. because like it's always New York or London. Like it's never, somewhere smaller or whatever. But yeah, there's a lot of people who've been abandoned by the parents, and the way that plays out differently for each person.
Yeah, abandonment is a huge theme of it. And on a larger scale, you can look at it. If you do want to look at it more politically, then it is about the sort of abandonment of the men, not just men, but the particularly the gay men by society, by politics, by the just by systemically everything, the utter neglect that governments, the American government, other governments, perpetrated to these men. And that, may I
I was going
segue?
to say, because I'm desperate to, because there's a bit in the other book that, but go on, you go first. Might be the same bit.
Might well be the same bit. And that sort of much more explicitly political aspect to it is what is in part incredibly explored in Close to the Knives, David Wronarowicz. So Wronarowicz was a artist, writer, activist. I think a lot of people will have seen some of his work without knowing who he is. Famously, one of his photos is used on the cover of a U2 album, the Buffalo Falling Through the Air, whatever it is. But he led this rather extraordinary life where he was, well, he had a terrible upbringing. He was homeless for a time. He was essentially kind of ended up in sort of child prostitution, just absolute abuse and sort of living on the streets. And he ended up, obviously this is in the 80s and early 90s as well. And so inevitably the AIDS crisis affected him very directly. He lost a lot of people around him, and he himself died in 1992, I think it was. And what this book is a sort of memoir collection of essays. It's not sort of A to Z, but it is a kind of fragmentary memoir of his life, of the people around him. It is furious. I mean, it's sort of some of the most eloquent anger I've read in a really long time. It's him sort of railing against what society has done to him and people like him. It's calling out politicians and the church by name, but also some incredibly moving writing about people in his life and people he's lost. And it's quite difficult to read in places just because of the intensity of it, I think. But I'm so glad that I have read it, and I think it's a really extraordinary book. So what was the bit that you were thinking of
Oh, just
specifically?
a bit when we were talking about The Great Believers about being abandoned. There's a bit in Close to the Knives where it was one of those where you just read it and you can't quite believe. So it's in a section called the Seven Deadly Sins fact sheet. This is the point where he is calling out different people who have just been appalling, really, in terms of their response to it. So this is Edward Koch, who is mayor at the time. Congressmen were assured by representatives of the city that no one should worry. These people will be dying so quickly from lack of treatment that there will be no visible increase of homeless PWAs on the streets. I mean, that brutal. And then it goes on to say, in the latest installment of his autobiography, this one a co-production with the Cardinal, the mayor relates a visit he made to a local ward for children with AIDS. Handing out cookies to the kids, he was so overcome with revulsion that he rushed to the nearest sink and tried to wash the experience away, in effect, literalizing what he has been doing since this crisis began, distributing sweets and washing his hands.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so this is the same section, and it's what he says about Cardinal John O'Connor, the world's most active liar about condoms and safer sex. No set of AIDS statistics alarms demographers more than the apparent spread of HIV infection among New York City's adolescents, many of them Latino, many of them in its neighborhoods dominated by the church. Prefers coffins to condoms. At Covenant House, a supposed safe haven for teenage runaways who frequently have to resort to hustling and prostitution for survival while on the streets, no condoms or safer sex information available, although there is a high rate of recidivism. The Archdiocese, which runs Covenant House, as well as keeping these children ignorant and putting them at great risk in order to maintain their moral code, will simply tell them it's their fault as they lay dying. No safer sex information or condoms talked about in parochial schools and Catholic-run youth agencies. Archdiocese serves on the Board of Education's AIDS Advisory Committee and lobbies heavily and incessantly against teaching about safer sex and or condoms. Vatican's position on violence against lesbian and gays. October 31st, 1986, after Gay Rights Bill passed. Vatican letter. Letter to the bishops of the Catholic Church on the pastoral care of homosexual persons. Issued by the Vatican Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, Section 12, Violence. When homosexual activity is consequently condoned, or when civil legislation is introduced to protect behaviour to which no one has any conceivable right, neither the Church nor society at large should be surprised when other disturbed notions and practices gain ground and irrational and violent reactions increase. Cannibal? The hierarchy of the American Church appears to have dug in for the Long Last Supper. Aside from the recent harassment of people who believe in choice with regard to abortion, threats of excommunication, etc., O'Connor, who missed his calling on soap operas, is installing a raised press platform in St. Patrick's Cathedral for television crews and reporters. His spokesman explained, "We have been planning this for a long time as a way of balancing the press's and the worshippers' needs." Yeah, just the rage and the horror, and, you know, I was reading it just feeling so furious and aghast. And these are children, you know. Not that that means that people who aren't children should deserve it, of course not, that's not what I mean, but it's just that it's meant to be a safe haven and they are telling them it's their fault. It's just horrifying.
Well, the hypocrisy of the church, isn't it? Well, you were reading it, there's a bit later on, so this is the very last essay, is a really long one, so I read it on Kindle and it's like an hour's, it's more than an hour's worth of reading, and it's about his friend who had died by suicide, and it's their other friends talking about what they think led to it, although there's lots of Wanarovich's commentary in there as well. I mean, sometimes he writes his dreams in it, but there's lots of commentary from him as well. And one of the quotes I highlighted from that was, "I know I'm not going to die merely because I got fucked in the ass without a condom or because I swallowed a stranger's semen. If I die, it is because a handful of people in power, in organised religions and political institutions, believe that I am an expendable."
Yep.
And I think there's sort of two things going on with this book, I think. There's that side of it, which is very straightforward. In terms of the writing is clean, I guess, is the word that I would use. Like it's very it's written for a purpose. So his purpose is that he wants to be very clear about what is happening to his community. And so you get sort of the second half of the book particularly is written like that. The first though, where it's much more sort of memoir-y, is so beautifully written, and I wasn't expecting this. So the first like couple of things I highlighted in this were just because the sentences were so good, and they're like he writes in really long sentences as well in the bits that the memoir sections are sort of very long sentences, and I just want to read a bit out so like we sort of give a sense of it. So this is from the very first piece, which is about him taking a road trip into America. So there's a lot about him his sex work, and also about him going into these like towns that are, and I mean, it really reminded me of very recent sort of Trump style, why the far right have risen again, ideas about the poverty in these towns, and you know, any, well, I suppose again, we're in a conservative era, aren't we? It's Reagan, it's Thatcher in the UK, very sort of so many parallels between then and now. So, but this is wait, so he, I think he's picked someone up at this point. Yeah, there's quite a few different men at this point, but this is, so he's with a man. And he says, in loving him, I saw a cigarette between the fingers of a hand, smoke blowing backwards into the room and sputtering planes diving low through the clouds. In loving him, I saw men encouraging each other to lay down their arms. In loving him, I saw small town labourers creating excavations that other men spent their lives trying to fill. In loving him, I saw moving films of stone buildings. I saw a hand in prison dragging snow in from the sill. In loving him, I saw great houses being erected that would soon slide into the waiting and stirring seas. I saw him freeing me from the silences of the interior life. And I just thought, like, the writing in the first half particularly is extraordinary in terms of how beautiful and moving it is when he's writing about things that are really quite dark, and it's still very political. I mean, it's political in a different way, I think, the first sort of half. I suppose it's back to, it's more personal, it's the personal side of it, whereas the other side becomes more overtly political. But yeah, I thought it was extraordinary, like as you said earlier.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I found really extraordinary about some of the writing, particularly in a couple of the essays, sort of right in the middle of the book, is how he can simultaneously write incredibly clearly and precisely about stuff that he's almost changing his mind about as he goes. You know, there's a point where he says, I'm a bundle of contradictions that shift constantly. This is a comfort to me because to contradict myself dismantles the mental physical chains of the verbal code. I abstract the disease I have in the same way you abstract death. Sometimes I don't think about this disease for hours. This process lets me get work done, and work gives me life, or at least makes sense of living for short periods of time. Because I abstract this disease, it periodically knocks me on my ass with its relentlessness. With almost any other illness, you take for granted that within a week or a month, the illness will end, and the wonderful part of the human body called the mind will go about its job erasing evidence of the pain and discomfort previously experienced. With AIDS or HIV infections, one never gets that luxury, and I find myself after a while responding to it for a fractured moment with my pre-AIDS thought processes. All right, this is enough already. It should just go away. It's a kind of, there's a clarity about the non-clarity, do you know what I mean? That I find completely sort of breathtaking to read. And I think even the bits that are sort of more emotional than angry, there's an essay where he's talking about his former partner, longtime friend. You know, he talks about him as his brother, his emotional connection, his father, his everything. Where he is clearly in the very last stages of the disease and dies. And in those last stages, he is like so many people, desperately looking for any cure that he can, and has found out about this doctor who's offering typhoid injections. And saying that it holds off the disease or relieves symptoms or something. And so Runarovich and another friend drive him to this doctor who turns out, of course, to be a total quack. And it's the moment of realization of Runarovich going into the place and realizing that all the people in the waiting room are people that they that him and Peter, who's his friend who is dying, they've seen at all the other clinics and know each other, and it's just that sad kind of heartbreaking desperation as all these people are being utterly taken advantage of by quacks who just want to take their money, basically. It's a sort of the final lack of dignity in a society that doesn't believe they are worthy of dignity that is just soul destroying.
Yeah, I found that bit incredibly difficult to read. And his friend's so like not really with it, is he? And the sort of his behavior at the time is just devastating. Yeah. I think the other thing I found really interesting about this and I enjoyed about it was he talks about lots of big ideas as well. So the idea about freedom, whether freedom actually exists. And there's a bit when he talks about government and God are interchangeable and that people have chosen for their lives to be dictated by one or the other. And I was like, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah, lots about freedom and what it means and whether there's actually whether it's possible. And I mean, he talks about there's a point where he says, some of us are born with the crosshairs of a rifle scope printed through the backs of our skulls. And this idea about morality being something that's created by rich white people. Yeah, which is something that I'm sure we must have talked about before in some senses, because that idea that, well, everything about society is created by rich white people, isn't it? That's like, it's the whole thing, I suppose the thing that it makes me think of at least is that whole thing about that the laws are basically for poor people, because if you're a rich person, you can just buy your way out of it. And I think that was one of the things that he pulls out that I think is interesting is right near the end. Life was essentially a series of activities designed so that one could pay out money to keep from dying. Yeah, there were just loads of sort of brilliant ideas in it. I mean, I think for people who are listening to this, you can tell from the amount that we've quoted from it. Like, I could just quote, like, you just need to go and read it because I could quote from it all day, to be honest.
Absolutely. I think there's probably something in every single essay that I could sit and read out. It's just, yeah, I think it's a really, really astonishing book. And I think I'm really glad that I've read these two books together, actually, because while they both have that central thing of the AIDS crisis in the 80s and early 90s, they give two such interesting takes on it. I mean, inevitably, I think the Mackay, it being a novel and it being the kind of novel that it is, it's devastating and human, but it isn't as gritty in any way, shape, or form as the Runarovich. And the characters in The Great Believers are not homeless teenagers that are having to hustle to survive. They are not addicts, predominantly. They are not, people who have had the kind of damaged, traumatic upbringing that Runarovich has had. Yeah, so the characters in The Great Believers are frankly more middle class than Runarovich and the people that he's talking about, which is not to say that their tragedy is lesser. It's absolutely not, but I've really sort of appreciated reading the two together because it's the different sorts of activism, it's the different sorts of experience, and ultimately that regardless of those economic conditions, the ending is the same. Society doesn't care any more for the middle class gay men than it does for Runarovich and the people on the streets and
Yeah, and I'm glad, like, one, also I'm glad that I read them together. I thought they made a really good sort of pairing. But also I'm glad that Mackay wrote the story that she did, because I think so. My favorite novel about this period is Niven Guvenden's This Brutal House, which is extraordinary, but it's set in New York, has exactly those sorts of characters, the Wonarovich type characters, and also all the things that I love that I've watched, like I'm thinking of Pose. So Pose as well, which is a TV series that I absolutely love. I feel like lots of the stories are those gritty stories, and I will say this as a working class writer, it's always those stories because they're the ones that like people think sell about that sort of anything that's to do with any sort of minority. So I think, like, I'm glad that Wanarowicz told his own story. I'm also glad that Mackay told the story that's like, it's interesting, isn't it, that normally it'd be the middle class story that dominates in these sort of situations, whereas I don't think it is when you're talking about AIDS in the 80s and 90s. So actually, I'm glad that novel exists and that she wrote it from a different perspective.
I think it, yes, and I think that might be because it's so easy for some novels to end up as tragedy porn, essentially. And the grittier and the more distressing detail you can cram into it, the better. And neither of these books do that. And the Runarovich has inevitably the grittier on the streets because that was his life and that was his experience. But Mackay has not sort of given into the temptation of just piling tragedy porn onto tragedy porn onto, it's not exploitative in a way that I think some novelists could end up being.
Yep.
So two outstanding books, probably the books of the series so far for me.
Yep, definitely.
But next week we will be talking about other books. So they've got a tough act to follow. Those two books are Standard Deviation by Katherine Heine and The Harpy by Megan Hunter, which I'm looking forward to both of them actually.
I've wanted to read them both for ages. So
Me
it's all marriage stuff next week. Not my favourite topic, but hey ho. Although I
That's
like
how
the
you feel
premise.
about it by the end of next week.
Yes. So in the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. We are also on Instagram. Kirsty is at Other Kirsty and I'm at Naomi Frisby. Otherwise, we will see you next week for marriage chat. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.